You're listening to the Hog Sports Network Daily Podcast. Now, here's your host, Matt Jones.
Happy Wednesday to you. Appreciate you being with us. Christina Long here with me this morning. We'll get to the news of the hour, which is that Sam Pittman was on the radio this morning on Chuck Barrett and Bo Mattingly's show and said that he is hopeful that Taylen Green can play against LSU. It's the first time we've heard from Sam Pittman since Saturday night, since Green was injured during the game against Tennessee. We heard from him, obviously, in the postgame, but this is the first time that we've heard from him this week. He says the hope is that Taylen will be able to practice next week in advance of the LSU game, and obviously the hope is that he will be able to play. This kind of something we've heard a little bit, you know, from people chatter behind the scenes that there is a good bit of optimism, but it's one thing to hear that, and it's another thing to hear from the head coach.
Right, for sure. And I was thinking about it. I was like, Sam probably really likes that this is the bye week when there's not as much media availability and his quarterback just got hurt and he doesn't have to talk about it as much. But no, I mean, today was the first day we've heard him speak since after the Tennessee game, and then he'll be on the SEC coaches teleconference a little bit while we're recording today. But yeah, I mean, I think it's good that they're optimistic. I think after seeing Taylen try to come back in and then come back out, it kind of seemed to me that he would probably be okay, obviously, when you don't know what the injury is or the severity. But the fact that he wasn't, like, done away, you know, he went to the locker room, he came back, whatever. I think that makes it, you know, I was feeling optimistic about it. And then, yeah, hearing it from Sam, you know, he wouldn't say that if he weren't sure.
This is Pittman's direct quote from the Chuck and Bo show. It says, "We're hoping that he'll be ready for LSU. And we're also hoping he'll be ready by next week to practice. Those are still up in the air a little bit. We feel confident that we can have him back. It's just we're not positive that will happen."
Right. And so it's not for sure, but he wouldn't say it at all if he didn't feel pretty good about it. You know, he wouldn't want to give people that and then have him not be available.
Pittman also talked about Malachi Singleton and just the way he led Arkansas on that game-winning drive last week. He said he did, quote, a wonderful job. But he also noted that Green is our number one quarterback for a reason. And, you know, give Singleton, give coordinator Bobby Petrino, give everybody who was involved, give Braylon Russell a lot of credit on that last drive, but give everybody who was involved credit for getting them down the field. But, I mean, your eyes tell you how different of an offense it is when you've got Green in the game and you had Singleton in the game.
Right, it totally is. And, you know, one of the things that's come up a lot is, like, the snap issues. And that was one of the most obvious things I thought was – It was so clear how different snapping to a 6'6 quarterback and a 6'1, 6 foot quarterback is, you know? So that was one thing. But yeah, I mean, like Pittman said, Green is a quarterback for a reason. Singleton is fine. You know, he did what he needed to do. It was awesome for them. So yeah, I mean, I think they would feel okay having Singleton, but yeah, it's not the same as having Green. It's a totally different skill set.
Of Singleton, Pittman said, quote, "Leading that last drive down there to score, that was big time. We're very fortunate that we have two good quarterbacks. But we obviously need Taylen back healthy." There's no doubt that Arkansas wants Taylen Green back healthy. And, you know, I think they need him back healthy. I think they need him in order to have a chance to beat LSU. It's kind of interesting. They go into an LSU game here at home with quarterback issues. You know, remember the last time LSU came here was when KJ Jefferson had gotten knocked out the week before and he couldn't play and they had Malik Hornsby play. And that was a game where Harold Perkins looked like he was the next coming of Lawrence Taylor. And it was just a terrible offensive game for Arkansas. They could have beaten LSU that day, I think, with competent quarterback play. They just didn't have it.
Right. It's funny to remember how that all played out and what we've seen happen with Perkins since, you know, how last season the biggest talking point about LSU, it felt like, was what are they doing with Harold Perkins? They changed how he was used, and it kind of hobbled him. And then now
he's not out there.
Right, exactly. So now he's hurt. And, you know, the same kind of thing started this season where it was they kind of changed his role again, maybe back to more what it was. But it was, is he still as good as he looked that freshman season, starting with that Arkansas game? And then, yeah, now he's done with the injury. So, yeah, it's kind of weird how that's played out. But, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if they have Green, they definitely have a shot.
With Perkins, it reminds me a little bit of Landon Jackson in that, remember Landon Jackson last year, we've talked about this, he had 6.5 sacks last year. 3.5 of them came against a freshman tackle against Alabama. Perkins, he had a good freshman year, but he had 4 sacks against Arkansas. If he doesn't have that performance, do we really think of Harold Perkins in the same way that we thought about him? Because when you would watch, you know, the highlights, the features on him, It was Arkansas highlight, yeah. Arkansas highlight, Arkansas highlight. I mean, that game clearly did a lot, you know, for people in terms of his perception. I think they're both very good players, but I also think sometimes a player can have this one out-of-his-mind game that maybe sets a too high of an expectation for him. And we're maybe seeing that a little bit with Landon Jackson, although I do think he's played two really good games here the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, early in the year when he was kind of not getting to do much and the whole pass rush in general wasn't really getting a lot of production, and it was kind of a little bit of a where's Landon Jackson, you know, he was getting, you know, double teamed, things were happening. So that was kind of a question that, yeah, you and I talked about off air, where it was like, is this, you know, kind of more just kind of level setting for him, or is it just, you know, is it just the context of what's happening in these games with him? And then he has broken out these last couple games and been back to more what we expected him to be.
Pittman also said this morning on radio, he said that he thinks that there's a chance, emphasize chance, doesn't mean it's going to happen, that they could have Patrick Kudus back for the LSU game, the offensive lineman who's been injured since the preseason with back problems. Also said that maybe defensive back Miguel Mitchell could be back. We don't know what's going on with him. Also, Jalen Braxton, cornerback, possibly could be back. I think he's been dealing with some tendonitis since the Oklahoma State game. Kudus, I don't know how much he really fits into the plan, but I guess if you've got him available, that's a big deal because it gives you a body that you trust. If something else were to happen on the offensive line, I'm not sure that he would come back and automatically insert himself into the offensive line. But Braxton, they think he's their best corner, at least their best cover corner in man.
Yeah, I mean, getting Braxton back would be huge. We've seen the secondary be a little bit banged up, guys kind of coming in and out there and with some mixed results. And so, yeah, I mean, I think getting Braxton back would be huge. He's the leader of that secondary. And then, yeah, I agree with you on Kudus. That was something that early on when he was first injured and early in the season when it sounded like, oh, maybe we'll have him back next week. And then it kind of turned into we realized it was more long term. But I remember talking to people about, you know, if and when he is available, how much do we actually see him? Because he missed so much of preseason practice. This offensive line has been practicing without him and has been made up of a different group for so long. How do you bring him back when he's ready?
You know, a name that he didn't mention this morning was Jaquindon Jackson. And he's one that I just kind of wonder what's going on with him. He wasn't on the field on the last drive. Why? We don't know. We know that he's been dealing with some ankle stuff pretty much even before he came to Arkansas, that it was something that he brought over with him from Utah. But I would assume that with him, it's one of those deals where the couple of weeks of rest is going to be a real big deal just to be able to get off that thing.
Yeah, I think so too. I think he's one of those guys that has been, you know, pretty much every game it feels like he's had to come off for a few series, you know, with different injuries. It's been cramps. It's been possibly that ankle kind of foot thing that he's had. We don't really know. And so it's not to the extent that he was injured at Utah. I mean, he was playing through, he talked about like a tendon, like being separated from his bone, and he missed games at Utah last season. And then was playing on an injury the rest and still had like 700 something yards. So he played through significant injury last season. And I think this is a little bit more kind of week to week wear and tear. He seems to have more than some other guys, but yeah, I think having this week off coming when it does, especially right in the middle of the season, will be really good for him, especially.
How many times have you seen the drone shots from Saturday night?
A couple, not as many as you probably.
I keep seeing them everywhere. The reason I bring that up is because yesterday, the TV ratings from last weekend came out, and Arkansas and Tennessee was the most watched game on TV. Not only the most watched game, it was the most watched program on television Saturday night. 5.3 million average viewers on ABC, according to the Nielsen ratings, and it peaked with 6.8 million viewers in the fourth quarter. You might wonder how that works. So basically what happens is that games or programs, whatever the case may be, on TV, they are measured every 15 minutes, maybe every 30 minutes, but they're measured periodically during the game, and then you just take an average number of what those numbers were each time there's a measurement. So that's how you get the average of 5.3 million. That's the number that's the number we pay attention to the most, is the average number, and then you've got the peak number, which I would assume is right at the end of the game, 6.8 million people tuning in to watch if Arkansas can score, can Tennessee answer, oh, now we've got the field rush, we're going to watch this. These are big numbers for an Arkansas game. You know, Arkansas is typically a team, because it's a small population state, because it's a smaller alumni base, it's not really a national brand. When Arkansas is going to get the attention on TV is when it's playing some of these bigger national brands. Tennessee, obviously that, but 5.3 million viewers for an Arkansas game is a lot. Kind of the base that I've always been told is like networks, if they can get 4 million plus, they're really pleased with the numbers, and obviously you go well over that here.
Yeah. Do we know what the average tends to be for an Arkansas game? Do we have any idea?
I do.
I figured you would. If anybody would, you would.
Well, I don't have the exact number. I could probably do some math here real quick, but not every game gets measured.
Right.
So like SEC Network yeah. does not get measured. ESPN or Disney, they choose not to pardon me, they choose not to measure SEC Network games. So like Alabama, Vanderbilt, nobody knows. I mean, I'm sure somebody knows, but it's not going to be public knowledge how many people watch that game. And it's going to be a lot lower than whatever Arkansas, Tennessee was. When you play on an over-the-air network, an ABC, a Fox, a CBS, an NBC, those games are going to obviously have a lot more than games on cable. You look at the top 11 games this year, all of them are on over-the-air networks. Most of them are on ABC, and I think a good reason for that is that most of them are SEC games. Most of them are SEC teams in these ABC games. But to answer your question, in their four measured games this year, I'm going off the top of my head, but they had 5.3 million for Tennessee. They had 2.8 million on ABC for Oklahoma State. They had 2.02 million on ESPN for Auburn, and they had 1.8 million on ESPN okay. for Texas A&M.
Wow, so that was a really significant jump to get up to that five. Yeah, that's a lot. And in right now, when everything, it feels like so much of college football is about TV ratings.
We're
going to
talk about that
money.
More.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like it's notable to have these. And obviously, you know, you're not going to expect them to get 5 million viewers every week. But it's getting that boost and performing the way that they did when they're on that kind of stage is huge for them.
So 5.3 million for Arkansas on ABC, the second highest number. It was actually the game that led into Arkansas, Tennessee, Auburn against Georgia. That one had 4.9 million on ABC. And then Arkansas went head-to-head against Washington, Michigan, a rematch of last year's national championship game that had a little over 4 million viewers on NBC. Those were the three highest-rated games of the weekend. And sometimes it can help when you've got, you know, because what I think what happens is people, they tune into a good game, and then they just kind of keep it on that network. Well, you had A&M Missouri, and that wasn't a good game, but it was something that a lot of people were talking about. It was the notable game that morning. And then you kind of roll into that, and well, here's Georgia, and Auburn kept that interesting for a little while. And then you go into Arkansas, Tennessee, so ABC really benefited from having that triple header. One more note on TV ratings. Interesting to me, two college football games outdrew a Major League Baseball playoff game at the same time between the Yankees and the Royals on TBS cable. That plays a factor in this. But that game had an average audience of 3.2 million. So,
yeah.
If you ever wonder, is college football bigger than everything else? Yes. NFL is about the only thing that can beat college football on a consistent basis.
Right. College football is kind of that second sort of – I guess I don't know about NBA numbers because I'm not an NBA fan.
NBA doesn't – well, I mean, you look at every year, and usually the top 100 broadcasts every year, like about 90 to 95% are NFL games. You'll get somewhere 4 to 5 probably college football games in there, and then you get the Emmy Awards. I mean, that's pretty much it. That's basically it.
I wouldn't have guessed the Emmys would be the top one. I would have thought like the Oscars.
Maybe it's the Oscars. Okay. I'm not a big movie buff. I'm sorry. And maybe both. See, I'm showing my ignorance here. It's an awards show. I know that. Maybe the Grammys get in there too. I'm not sure.
Yeah, maybe.
But anyway, you usually like get one award show, a handful of college football games, and then like 90 something NFL games. Those are the 100 most watched things of the year.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
It was most viewers for Arkansas, by the way, since the 2022 game against Alabama. We got much more to come here today on the show. When we come back, we're going to answer your questions. We'll do a mailbag feature. But first, a word from our sponsors.
Want to enjoy your life again? Burning, numbness, and general pain in your feet and legs might be keeping you from your daily activities. Neuropathy treatment can be effective to restoring your life. Come see what we can do at Enhanced Healthcare Wellness Institute in Uptown Rogers. We can treat your neuropathy pain and get you back in the game of life. Enhanced Healthcare Wellness Institute is located at 5102 West Pauline Whitaker Parkway in Uptown Rogers.
At Kendall King, we're proud of over 4 decades of design. We're continuing the legacy of great creative design by combining our brands of Kendall King, Soapbox, and ShopCart. Together, these brands represent a new focus in marketing design with individual attention to specific areas. Through our design expertise supported by a team of talented professionals, we showcase our best. We are Kendall King, we are Soapbox, we are ShopCart, we are Design.
Hey, we want to tell you about our friends over at Enhanced Healthcare Wellness Institute. They are your source for holistic wellness and your healthy lifestyle changes. They're located in Uptown Rogers, and the staff at Enhanced Healthcare will target your specific health plan for wellness, from neuropathy treatment, primary care, weight loss, and so much more. You can count on the experts at Enhanced Healthcare Wellness Institute in Rogers. All right, we're going to take an opportunity here to kind of kill two birds with one stone, so to speak. We had a mailbag feature on our website, but we're going to incorporate that into our podcast as well. And we got five questions that we're going to answer here over the course of the next several minutes. And Blake Sutton, our producer, is going to read them to us. Blake, fire away.
All right. From Hog 2009, are we sure Bobby Petrino is an elite offensive coordinator? Through three SEC games, the offense is averaging 20 points per game. How sustainable is this?
All right. You want to go?
Yeah, I mean, so Ethan Westerman and I kind of split this story up answering some reader questions. First of all, our message board comes through with some pretty good questions.
Usually. They do.
They come through with some thinkers. And so Ethan took this one, but I want to give some of my thoughts too. I think I was interested going into this season about, because Bobby Petrino, you know, has the reputation of being this innovator, this great offensive mind. And I had heard, you know, I listened to some national podcasts, listened to some other kind of talking heads give their thoughts. And some people had pointed out, you know, when was the last time he had a great offense after like Lamar Jackson? Like, even, you know, his Missouri State teams were good. And I haven't looked into the numbers on that, but I think there were some questions from some people on the outside of, does he still have it? You know? And I think, so far this season, numbers wise, they're doing really well. It's showing a lot of improvement. I also think, and one thing that Ethan wrote in his response to this on Whole Hog Sports was, Arkansas has faced some good defenses in SEC play. Like, they haven't faced anybody, you know, Auburn is not a good team, but they have a pretty good defense, and the defense played pretty well against Arkansas. And so they haven't faced a team that they haven't underperformed, I would say, relative to the defense that they're facing. They haven't gone up against anybody that you expect them to smash, and then they don't. I think they've performed really well numbers wise. And I just think that what the problem is turning it into points and taking advantage of some opportunities. And that was something I wrote about on a different question that I think we'll get to in a bit, just about the ability to capitalize. And I think, but schematically, and as far as the general results that they're getting, I do think it's working. The Bobby Petrino experiment seems to be working so far. And I'll be curious, you know, it's not over. They're still, the hardest part of their schedule hasn't even gotten here yet, you know, and they've got Ole Miss, they've got Texas, they've got, you know, some teams with some good defenses too. And so I just think we're going to have to see more, and we're going to have to see, I think one of the keys will be how this offense improves, how it solves some of the problems we've seen, and how it adjusts throughout the season. That's one of the things that defines great teams, is how they grow over the course of a season, how they adjust to the problems that they have, and what they do when those problems arise.
Are you tired of hearing about efficiency ratings yet?
No.
Well, because
I know how hard you work on them.
I don't work hard. Man.
Yeah, you do.
I got a whole spreadsheet here. Have you seen my spreadsheet?
I haven't seen your
thoughts.
Yeah. See, you work hard. There's so many numbers.
Work. I don't know how hard of a work it is. But so I'm going to the efficiency ratings. Arkansas right now, they are scoring, or they have scored at about 26.5% of all their points that are possible. If they just make field goals, that's higher. That's probably closer to about 30%.
Yeah.
I know you can't expect field goal kickers to make everything, but you kind of expect it. So if they just make their field goals, that's a lot higher. There is an inefficiency to this offense, and I don't know that it's necessarily because of the coordinator. I think it's because it's more because of the special teams. It's more because of turnovers. Turnovers have played a big key in this. But, you know, the number of opportunities, if you know, and I don't really have a great way to equate yards to points or any like that, but when you look at how many yards they had against Oklahoma State, and they've got 15 possessions, and they only come away with 31 points. That's a terribly inefficient day. Auburn, a little bit different. I thought Auburn, like you said, their defense is decent. The efficiency ratings show that. They're number 10 in the SEC, but there's some really good defenses in the SEC this year. I'd say there's at least 8 really, really good defenses in the SEC. And Auburn's right there on the outside of that, and I think they've had some good games. Texas A&M, Arkansas was not good that day. Texas A&M's defense is really good. Tennessee, I was surprised with how well they moved the ball against Tennessee, because, you know, based on the efficiency, Tennessee's got the second best defense in the SEC, just behind Ole Miss. It's very close between them for 1 and 2. So, I don't know. As an elite offensive coordinator, he got him in position to do enough the other night and beat a team they didn't think they had a chance to beat. I mean, weren't you surprised that they had as many yards and as many scoring opportunities as they did against Tennessee?
For sure. They had. I mean, that was the thing. They had they gave themselves the opportunity. I feel like the problems with the offense have been more about execution and less about scheme or situational kind of things. I was just thinking just now about how I feel like when I covered in 2021 and 2022 the Kendall Briles offense, it was – I felt like every couple of weeks there would be – the talking point would be what was this play call by Kendall Briles in this, you know, crunch situation.
Mm-hmm.
It felt like every couple of weeks there was something where everybody was like – the big question was, why would they do that? What was that play call? What were they doing late in the game? Whatever. And I don't feel like we've had that with Petrino so far. I mean, we've had more questions about execution and performance than we have about scheme, play calling, things like that.
Here's my guess. They play LSU after a bye week. I think they'll have a better offensive game efficiency-wise against LSU. And then they play Mississippi State. Mississippi State's not as bad as UAPB defensively, but they're not too far away.
Yeah, Mississippi State
they're
is...
They're very, very bad
they
defensively.
They are not good. They are not good.
So I think that efficiency number will go up over the next couple of games. Blake?
Next one is from Scavenger Hog. How is the coaching staff helping the team stay up, yet get the rest and recovery needed so that they are as on fire going into this stretch of needed wins against really good teams?
We heard Pittman talk a little bit about this morning.
Yeah, he talked about kind of their off-week schedule and how, you know, they'll do some walkthrough stuff, then they'll do some spiders, you know, partial pads, and then they'll do full pads, and they have the weekend off, and the coaching staff will meet Sunday, and then they'll get back into their regularly scheduled week. And so I think they're really conscious of how many injuries they have and how many banged up guys they have, and they're trying to take advantage of this rest. But he also was talking about how they've already started on their LSU film, of course, and so they're already working on that. And I think it's hard to avoid, especially coming off of a win like that. It's hard to avoid that kind of hangover. You know, you have that big, emotional, exciting win, and how do you not sit back and go, wow, how great was that? We're going to be great for the rest of the year. How do you actually make that happen? And I actually think having a week off right after this win is better for that. I would think if they won and then this weekend had to play an LSU team that's, you know, pretty good, head-scratcher, but I think if they were coming off this game going directly into their next game, I think it would actually be harder to shake that off than, mm-hmm. you know, having this week off time to say, okay, that was awesome. Let's put it to the side. Let's refocus.
That's a good point. That's a good point. And we focus on the off week and how beneficial it is to them from a rest point. But I think, like, getting their mind rested and refocused on what needs to happen, that's a great point.
Next one is from Colorado Hog. What is going on with the center snaps? Can and how can that be corrected?
Yeah, I mean, I took this one on our story. So Addison Nichols, the center, this is his first season playing center in college. He was a guard at Tennessee. And that's not an excuse. Like, ever since he got here, when he came to Arkansas, the plan was to put him at center. This was not an emergency move. He's known he was going to be center. He's been working at that all offseason. But that's kind of an explanation, I would say. And Pittman has talked about this pretty in depth. He's talked about how he struggles, especially when he's snapping to the left. He's snapping to the left, it goes to the right. And then Green has to kind of adjust, try to catch it. That's affecting some of the timing issues we've seen with Green, which might be hurting some of the accuracy, some of the needing to go on the run, you know, panicking a little bit because he has to take the extra beat to handle that. He also said some of Nichols' snaps are too fast.
Mm-hmm.
And so Talon's kind of trying to, you know, trying to catch it, trying to secure it. And that, like I said, throws the timing off at times.
But didn't it seem like it was better the other night? I don't remember as many issues against Tennessee as I've remembered the other games.
No, it didn't start until Singleton came in. And like I said, that's a totally different adjustment.
Different,
yes, totally different guy. So that does make it harder. But I didn't notice any major issues when Green was in the game.
I thought the offensive line played outstanding against Tennessee. I was focused in on Keyshawn Blackstock a few times, and it seemed like every time that I watched him, he held up, you know, fairly well in pass protection, and that's been a point of concern, not just with him, but with other players on the offensive line. I thought it was a really good offensive line performance because that's where I thought they were going to fall apart against Tennessee, based on the reputation that Tennessee's defensive linemen had, and the reputation, maybe not reputation's the right word, but just the results that Arkansas had to that point. I didn't think they were going to be able to hold up against Tennessee, and like I said, I thought it was the best game they played this year.
Yeah, I didn't either. I was really, really surprised. I'll be, you know, now the question is, can they keep doing it? You know, is this a permanent, is this a corner turned, or is this a,
I would think it's a corner turn.
I would hope so.
You heard Pittman talk about it this morning. He said a lot of it was not technical, it was mental.
Mm.
And he felt like they had turned a, I don't know if he said corner, but he felt like they had fixed some things mentally that had been hurting him for the previous few weeks against Tennessee.
Yeah.
Like,
next one is from Hog Moto. Talen Green's tunnel vision on Armstrong is obvious. Can Bobby get him to use all of his receivers, not just Armstrong?
I heard somebody say the other day, they said if you really want to affect Talen Green, blitz him from the side that Andrew Armstrong is opposite of.
Seriously. Like, it was really obvious, I think. I think it had started to come up as a question after, what was it, the Texas A&M game. And then it was really, really obvious on the play where Isaac Tislaw was wide open, headed for the end zone, and he just didn't see him. Tislaw's arms are up. He's like, hello. Mm-hmm. Green just doesn't see him, goes to Armstrong, and would have had a touchdown in the Tennessee game. And so I think that was something that made people go, wow, this really is, you know, this is really a problem. And I think what happens is, I think it stems from some of the protection issues, which we just established were a lot better against Tennessee. But I think sometimes he kind of gets into that panic mode and he looks for the guy that he knows mm-hmm. can do it. Because Armstrong, every time, he's so lucky that Armstrong is so good and has, you know, he can catch anything. And so he's so fortunate because he knows he can look for him and he knows that he'll get it.
You know what I see? I think Armstrong is the best receiver by a good bit at coming back toward Green on those uh-huh. what you call, you know, panic plays, whenever he is rolling outside the pocket, which we've seen so many times this year. I think Armstrong does as good of a job as anybody at coming back to him and, you know, finding that soft spot. And that's where I think we're seeing him get a lot of his catches this year, are on those rollouts, on those plays that break down. And it's just Talen Green and Andrew Armstrong have got a really good rapport with one another. So I think there's some validity to it. I do think that he does, you know, Armstrong is his number one receiver, so he's going to be his number one option on a lot of plays. But I think some of it is just trust issues in those moments when the play is going wrong.
Right, and I think it's, you know, Armstrong, it's working overall so far, but I do think, you know, things like that where you just miss your open guy, those are things that probably make Bobby Petrino insane, you know? And so that's another thing we go back to, is Bobby Petrino an elite offensive coordinator? You know, how did they improve that? How do they fix that? Green has a lot of growing to do. I think he's doing a lot of that growing through this first half of the season. But this is another one that I think we're going to have to see him continue to work on.
All right, Blake, last one.
All right, this last one is from Southpaw. Who made the decision to play the Houston Nut pep talk on the big screen at the start of the fourth quarter?
Okay, so if you didn't see this, and if you're not sure about what speech we're talking about, here's the Houston Nut speech. We've got this queued up.
This is what it's all about. This is what it's all about. This is your home. You hear that? You hear that? That's special. There's a lot of lions, tigers, and bears, but they ain't but one Razorback. Number one, all I want you to do tonight is play your best. Don't worry about making a mistake. You make a mistake, that's fine, as long as you're going 100 miles an hour. Hit him right up in the mouth and pick him up. Somebody kicks you after the play, smile at him and say, I'll see you in 25 seconds. I'll see you in 25 seconds. It's about little things, fellas. Poise and confidence. Poise and confidence. When one of your teammates makes a play, I want to see 10 to come tell him. Somebody makes a tackle, a big hit, I want to see 10, don't tell him. You play like the Razorbacks, fellas, you're ready. You are ready, physically and mentally, you're ready. We hit this field, we hit it better than anybody in the country.
All right, so there's Houston Nutt. I think it ends with, you're ready. Do you watch this whenever they played this at the start of the fourth quarter?
I heard part of it, yeah. I'm not always totally tuned into the video board, but I heard part of it.
So I looked up there, you know, a couple, pretty early on in it, and it was interesting. They had like, I'm going to sound ignorant when I talk about this, but you know, they had some dramatic pauses in what he was saying. They had some video clips that were going over what he was talking about. You know, you hear that, and you get people calling the Hogs. And they had, you know, I think they had his words on the screen as he was saying them. So, you know, it's like watching one of your Taylor Swift lyric videos on YouTube. Houston Nutt, his lyric video, I guess, for lack of a better term. But who made the decision? I'm guessing that it's the marketing people who are in charge of pretty much everything that goes into the game day atmosphere, the game day environment.
Right, all that stuff, music choices, sound effects. There were some people there. I guess I was going to ask you about this. Somebody on the board was talking about there was like a siren that was like really bothering them. I didn't notice
it. I didn't hear a siren. I heard a train whistle a lot.
Oh, maybe
the
that's what they meant. Yeah, maybe it was that.
It's the same train whistle they use at Baum, I think, whenever they hit a home run.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah, so that should be like a happy.
I mean, they were laying on that train whistle on Tennessee's last drive. It was.
That's
every
funny.
Yeah. Train, like, we need to get sound effects. We need to be able to play train whistles.
Train whistle.
I just point at you and you can play a train whistle.
Toot toot.
But they've done a lot. I feel like I've noticed a few different things as far as in-game entertainment stuff. I always like the videos like that. I feel like those would be that would be such a fun job to make those.
Well, and the point they were making is that the players were sitting there watching that.
Yeah, which is really cool.
I think it's kind of cool how they brought Houston. Like, enough time has passed that, you know, Houston is, he's back in the fold to a certain extent. I mean, we had him on our show last week. Yeah. I think he was on like two or three other shows last week too. Maybe it was because of the new documentary that was coming out. I don't know why, but that's why he was on our show. I can tell you that. But this was a cool feature I thought that they had in the stadium before the game. I've said this every day this week. I think that the atmosphere at the game Saturday night was as good as probably any football game atmosphere I can remember in Fayetteville.
Yeah, it was awesome. I was talking to some friends last night, and they were talking about how they have a coworker who's from Baltimore. He's pretty new. He just moved to the area, and he's, you know, a big Ravens fan, whatever. And he was like, "Yeah, I've never really had a college team." You know, and somebody was like, "You should adopt the Razorbacks now that you live here. You should go to the game this weekend." So he just got a ticket, went to the game by himself, and his first Razorback game was this one. And I was like, "All right, he's gonna be hooked now. Like, they got a fan this weekend."
I know who's in charge of the game day stuff, and I reached out to him the other day. I said, "Hey, would you want to come on the podcast? Everybody's talking about the atmosphere. You want to talk about, you know, everything that went into that?" And they just sent me a text and said, "I don't mind being under the radar on this one. Let's let that be a team effort."
Yeah,
so
that's awesome.
So there you go. So that, I don't know if that answers the question. I think it answered the question about the Houston Nut video.
Marketing people.
The marketing department. Yeah, they're kind of in charge of everything that you hear on game day. All right, when we come back, we're going to talk about Project Rudy. If you haven't heard about this, it's interesting. There's a lot of things going on behind the scenes, as it seems like there always are in college football. And this is one that people are talking about today. We'll talk about that in just a moment, but first, another word from our sponsors.
Want to enjoy your life again? Burning, numbness, and general pain in your feet and legs might be keeping you from your daily activities. Neuropathy treatment can be effective to restoring your life. Come see what we can do at Enhanced Healthcare Wellness Institute in Uptown Rogers. We can treat your neuropathy pain and get you back in the game of life. Enhanced Healthcare Wellness Institute is located at 5102 West Pauline Whitaker Parkway in Uptown Rogers.
At Kendall King, we're proud of over four decades of design. We're continuing the legacy of great creative design by combining our brands of Kendall King, Soapbox, and ShopCart. Together, these brands represent a new focus in marketing design with individual attention to specific areas. Through our design expertise supported by a team of talented professionals, we showcase our best. We are Kendall King, we are Soapbox, we are ShopCart, we are design.
Hey, welcome back. I want to tell you about our friends over at Bentonville Glass. They've been serving their community since 1971. They're committed, professional, and versatile. If you're looking for a quality leader in Northwest Arkansas or looking for skilled craftsmanship, look no further than Bentonville Glass for all your glass market needs with the highest quality products. You can come by and see them today at 507 South Main in Bentonville or online at bentonvilleglass.com. You know, last week I couldn't find my Bentonville Glass reader, and I just kind of went into, I know this thing by heart now. Boom. That's how much I believe in Bentonville Glass. We thank them for being a sponsor of our show. All right, Project Rudy. It's something people are talking about today. Basically, fill in the blanks for me, Christina. It's basically a private equity group that is coming in and pitching to Power 5 conferences, Power 5 athletic directors, a vision for the future of college football, in which and there's a lot of holes, I think, to fill in here. But basically, they would take the ACC, the SEC, Big 10, and Big 12, and for lack of a better term, they would create a super league out of roughly 70 teams that are part of those leagues plus Notre Dame, and they would control TV, they would control scheduling, they would eliminate group of five games against, say, SEC teams, they would eliminate these FCS games that are terrible to watch, and they would make a they would basically make a like a another like a bigger version of the NFL, where you've got attractive matchups, you've got a more uniform TV deal, more rivalries would be preserved. They would be played on a more regular basis than some of them are played right now. It's not the only group that's coming at the conferences and the schools right now and saying, we've got an idea. There's another one called like Project Tomorrow, I think.
Something like that.
Or like the Vision for Tomorrow. I'll find it here in just a minute. But they've also, you know, they've outlined their ideas. Yahoo Sports is the one who first reported on Project Rudy. And basically, they said it's three former Disney executives who have gone into capital investment with one another. And they're kind of the ones who are behind this. And they've got Jack Swarbrick on board with them, who's the former Notre Dame athletic director and who's always been a very powerful player in the decisions that have been made, whether it be college football playoff, you know, other college decisions. And so it's interesting. I don't get the sense that it's going to really go anywhere. But the feeling, I think, from people in this story and just the feeling that you kind of get just, you know, seeing which way the wind's blowing, is that it's going to be – there's going to be some sort of outside entity that could potentially come in and totally change the way that college sports is done.
Yeah, I mean, this is not the first time we've heard the rumblings of Super League and whatever, but this is the most tangible, I think, example we've seen of them trying to make it happen. Now, Greg Sankey, the SEC commissioner, is quoted in this story from, you know, not an interview
not
for
directly,
this story.
Not directly, but he's been asked about this concept.
Right, not about this, not about Project Rudy specifically, but he has talked about the fact that he's not that interested in the concept. He basically said, you know, the SEC, we're what everybody's trying to get to. Why should we help them get there, basically? So, I mean, I don't think this is definitely not something that's guaranteed to happen. There's a lot of people they got to convince. But Big Ten and SEC leaders are meeting, I think, this week or next week, and this is one of the things that they'll be talking about.
This is a quote from Sankey in the Yahoo story. He was on a podcast with Urban Meyer has a podcast?
Apparently. Everybody has a podcast.
Everybody has, we've got a podcast. Urban Meyer is a podcast recently. This is what Sankey said. He said, I don't want to dumb down the Southeastern Conference to be part of some Super League notion with 70 teams that some people speculate would happen. They want to be us, and that's on them to figure it out, not on me to bring myself back to Earth. Boy, those are some strong comments.
I know. Yeah, Greg will say it. Yeah. No, it's interesting. There's a lot of people they got to convince, but that doesn't mean that they can't.
And the two most important, it feels like they've got to convince, are Sankey and Tony Petitti, who's the Big Ten commissioner.
Right. And I think, yeah, this meeting of those league leaders, I think, I can't remember if it's this week
it's
or
today.
Next week. It's today.
It's today.
Oh,
in Nashville.
Okay. So it's today. You know, this is one of the things, it's not all about this, but this is one of the things that they'll talk about. And so I think this will be something that we're going to have to follow for a while. There's this Yahoo Sports story quotes a few different anonymous administrators from different leagues who all kind of seem to think, this is some form of this will come eventually. Is now the time? Maybe not. But in the next 10, 15 years, this might be what it looks like.
The allure of this is the infusion of cash
into the
programs, where they're basically saying, hey, we can guarantee you that you're going to, you know, make on average $25 million more per year. Well, what's happening right now? You got the House settlement that was preliminarily approved earlier this week by Claudia Wilkin, the judge in the Northern District of California. And so that, it's not finalized. There's still some hurdles that they have to go through to get the House settlement finalized and approved and ready for implementation in middle part of next year. There are some objections to the, you know, to the settlement that they still have to get through. But it looks like, you know, for all intents and purposes, that it's moving toward implementation next year. But as part of that, they're going to have to, on average, it starts out at about $21 to $22 million a year, but that stair steps every year. And on average, it's going to be somewhere around $28 million over 10 years that the schools are going to be paying in revenue share. And so now you got these people coming along saying, hey, we could give you $25 million. I think that's got people listening to them at least.
Right. And I think one of the things in here that's really important is this proposal with the, it's about 70 programs separated into three tiers. And so basically this would be, this is according to the Yahoo story, tier one, the top 16 schools earn per school revenue projections from $130 million in year four, escalating to $250 million in year 12. So that is double what the SEC and Big Ten currently distribute to their member schools.
Mm-hmm.
Tier two, the next 22 schools, 60 to 110 million, which is similar to the current SEC and Big Ten mm-hmm. distributions. And then the last tier is the last 32 schools. So that's the biggest group, but the bottom group, 30 to 60 million, similar to what the Big 12 and ACC are paying out.
See, that's where I feel like this falls apart.
Yeah.
Because I don't think all the schools are going to, if you're Arkansas, you don't want to say, hey, I'm going to voluntarily yes. take, be in tier two or tier three, when the teams that I'm competing against are going to make how much more?
Almost double.
Yeah, I mean, so
yeah.
Why would you voluntarily do that? Why, as a commissioner, would you do that?
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think the problem is some of the top schools are going to want it so much. You know, the Alabamas, the Georgias, the whatever, they're going to be very satisfied with the idea of, oh, you know, it's the same argument we see within conferences right now. If I make, you know, I, Alabama, or I, Clemson, or I, Florida State, makes this conference so much media money, why does Boston College get the same amount of money as me when I get them the TV ratings?
Blake, did you have a thought?
Yeah, I've got a question. So, you know, back when D1 split into like D1A, D1AA, D1AAA.
Mm-hmm. Subdivisions.
Right. And then over time, D1A became the FBS, D1AA became FCS. But then you have FCS teams moving up to FBS.
Mm-hmm.
What's to stop that from happening with this 70 team league? Is there going to be teams on the outside that try to get in, and then you have the same problem? You have 100 teams in this league and the bottom, you know, 30 can't compete.
Well, I think that's why there's such a this last round of realignment felt so pressing, because the teams like read like what's happened with the Pac-12 right now. You know, is the Pac-12, are they part of this? It doesn't seem like they are right now. You know, what happens to an Oregon State and a Washington State? Do they say, hey, well, you know, we were power last year, are we part of? I think that's why there's such a, especially with the Pac-12 right now, there's such a urgency to get on board with the Pac-12 from some of these schools, because it feels almost like this is our last ditch effort to, you know, get to that power status, assuming that they, you know, the four teams let the Pac-12 back into the fold, which I don't know that there's any real guarantee that that's going to happen. In fact, I would say it's probably questionable at best.
Right. I don't know if this is something where the 70 schools are locked in contractually and you don't, you know, maybe there's a renegotiation.
Well, they talk about a relegation system here, but I think that's more
that's
through
within
the tiers.
That's right. Not out of the thing. So that's another thing that's
interesting. And then there was also talk about there's going to be 8 teams that would permanently be in tier one.
Which is crazy.
So I'm guessing, you know, that's probably Notre Dame, Texas, Ohio State, Alabama, Michigan.
Yeah.
You know,
and I mean, that's the one where I'm like, how is any other school outside of those 8 or 16 or whatever it is, how is anybody going to let that happen? But it's the same kind of thing we're seeing with the college football playoff, where these, you know, the SEC and the Big Ten are trying to get more guaranteed spots in the playoff just for being the Big Ten and the SEC. So it's the same kind of idea. But the tier thing, so the model apparently offers, Yahoo says, a variety of ways to determine how to tier schools. The previous season results, perhaps, or an aggregate of results over a stretch of seasons. Also features a relegation and promotion system to pave a way for schools to move up and down the tiers. But yes, there is a version that has 8 permanent members of tier one, which seems crazy. Because, but then when you think about the, I'm not opposed to the idea of the promotion relegation. I almost think you would have to have that, because, like you said, why would schools agree to be in tier three?
If you're going
to
make this the NFL, though, why not just make it the NFL?
Yeah, that's
kind of how
I feel. In
the NFL, you basically, I mean, I'm not pretending I know all the ins and outs of the NFL, but basically you're getting pretty much kind of the same cut of revenue.
Right.
And then it's up to you to figure out, how do you make your team more marketable?
Yeah.
You know, how do you sell more jerseys? How do you sell tickets? How do you do all these things? Like Jerry Jones was a total pioneer visionary when he went to Nike when the NFL was with whoever, or he went to Pepsi when the NFL was with Coke, or he went to Miller Lite when the NFL was with, you know. And so that's how you, to me, it's like, if you want everybody to be part of this Super League, then offer them the same thing.
Yeah.
And then let the onus be on Texas or Ohio State or whoever to go out and be more marketable if they want to make more money than an Arkansas or an Arizona State.
And the thing is, they already are. So, like, you know, there's like we were talking about earlier with Arkansas and Tennessee. Arkansas, not as much of a national brand. Tennessee, yeah, more of one. More marketable. They probably sell, you know, they have more what some people call, well, like sidewalk fans or t-shirt fans, people that are kind of casual.
I love
but they
t-shirt
have
fans.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
so
my favorite.
Yeah, so you have more of those. Teams like Alabama, teams like Ohio State, they already will have a leg up if you have that model because of their marketability, their big brand. Other schools can build those brands. But yeah, I mean, I just think they already are ahead. But like we've talked about before, there's never enough money. So if you can wave more money in front of people and you make that a possibility, they're always going to push for the option that gives them the most money.
So the SEC Big Ten scheduling talk today in Nashville, this is according to Yahoo. Basically, what they are talking about is a scheduling arrangement that would create more made-for-TV matchups. Obviously, the more, you know, quality TV matchups, like we were talking about earlier, the more revenue you're going to be able to, you know, ask, you're going to be able to get whenever you go back to the negotiating table when these different television contracts come up for renewal. So the question becomes, does the SEC go to a 9-game schedule? Because it kind of feels like right now the Big Ten will not play ball with the SEC, so to speak, as long as the Big Ten is playing 9 conference games and the SEC is playing 8. I mean, that sounds fair.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I feel like they'll probably go to 9
Because if they
games.
Did this, then you would have Big Ten teams that would be playing 10 power conference teams guaranteed, and the SEC would only be playing 9 power conference games guaranteed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unless you're Florida, who for some reason, when their head coach is on the hot seats, decided to play 11 of 12 games this year against power conference teams.
Yeah. Go they figure. Really hurt Billy on that one.
Boy, I mean, my goodness. They set him up to fail,
yeah.
I feel like.
Yeah. So, I mean, I feel like they'll go to 9 games because of that. I think that's what's coming.
See, Juracek, I heard him speak, I don't remember when it was. It's been within the last month or two, I feel like. And, you know, I think he said something like he doesn't feel like there was a whole lot of momentum for 9 games, mm-hmm. like because the current system has been so good to the SEC with an 8-game conference schedule. Why change it? They've had so much success getting, obviously, a team into the playoff that's going to be in the championship game most years, and sometimes, multiple times, they've had 2 teams in the playoff. They feel like in a 12-team playoff, they're probably going to get 3, 4, maybe even 5 teams on the right year into the playoff. Why change it from 8 games to 9? But there's all these extenuating circumstances that are going on, you know, on the outside that might force them to do that. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I feel like the idea, the allure of having these big matchups that will draw a lot of TV viewers, more of those games.
You can't be playing Arkansas versus Louisiana Tech anymore.
Right, right. That's the problem.
Or Arkansas UAPB.
When TV is king, I think that's just everything, and maybe this is a pessimistic view of things, but
no,
I just am
not.
Always like, if the option is more money or not as much money or more viewers or not as many viewers, they're always going to take more, always.
It would be like the equivalent of the Cincinnati Bengals playing the Birmingham Stallions of the UFL. I mean, that's basically
right.
what
yeah.
you see when you've got Arkansas or Alabama or whoever stepping out of the SEC and going to play a Kent State, a Toledo,
but the problem,
FCS team.
Where I push back, though, is sometimes you do get some good, not with FCS, but with Group of 5 games, you get some good, interesting games. You get crazy upsets sometimes. You get, you know, if you play a good G5 team, there
okay.
are, you know, teams playing Boise State. Who wants to play Boise State right now?
You think the
no
Birmingham
one.
Stallions could beat the Carolina Panthers? I do. I think they might make, I might,
not
I think
with
they
Andy
might
Dalton
give them
at quarterback.
You think Andy Dalton would beat the Stallions?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, that's another conversation for another. The point being that TV, you know, the NFL, they want quality matchups on TV. And college football, at some point, that's going, I don't know if it's going to be the next 5 years or 10 years, but that's going to be the next, I feel like it's going to be the next evolution of college football, is going to be when, like what we're seeing right now with the ACC and Big Ten, or the SEC and Big Ten commissioners getting together, it's going to be all about how do we get more quality matchups on TV?
Yeah.
Because there's too often where you just don't have enough quality matchups on TV, especially early in the year.
Yeah.
And that's where college football's got to grow, I feel like. So.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. I think we'll see that. I mean, their motivation right now is to get TV viewers, is to get TV mm-hmm. money, and they're going to do what serves that goal.
They need more field stormings. Get more TV viewers. That's what got them a bunch for Arkansas and Tennessee.
Stop finding teams for it because it makes you.
What do you think about that? What do you think about that?
About finding them?
About finding them, yeah. Because there's no way. There's two things here. Number one, the fine is supposed to be a deterrent.
Yeah,
it doesn't deter anybody. It doesn't deter anybody. And there's no way, you know, I mean, short of having, I don't know, 1,500 Navy SEALs circled around the stadium that you're going to be able to hold people. I know the event staff people. I know a lot of them.
People.
It's a lot. Not everybody, but there's a lot of retired.
Yes, they people are not who it's going just to a build supplemental a physical income. Wall to no. prevent students from getting. No, they are gonna let it happen, and I don't blame them. I would also
Connie's
be like, don't
gonna let
hurt
them run
me.
Right past her.
Yes, I would be like, just don't run me over, like, because what can you do in front of all those people? What are you supposed to do? So, yeah, I mean, I think the fines.
There was talk that the SEC might pull a home game from a team in the future if they had a field storming event. And I don't think that went anywhere. That was maybe a year or two ago at the SEC spring meetings when they were talking about that. Because then all of a sudden, you know, I mean, a home game's worth $8, $10, $12 million.
That's a financial hit, yeah.
Depending on how big your stadium is, how many premium seats you have in it. So yeah, that then they're but and also it hurts the fan base because then somewhere down the road you don't have, you know, you're playing five home games while your opponents are playing six or seven.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the fines, like, in principle, having something to prevent it, because it is, you know, I think it's cool. You know, everybody likes to, it's cool when people
it's fun until somebody gets hurt.
Exactly. It is and there extremely have been dangerous. Like, it's very, it's dangerous for players, it's dangerous for fans, it's everybody involved. It really is, not to be like a party pooper, but it really is. And so I think the idea of having something to try to deter it, I just think the fines aren't actually, like, there's no teeth to that.
No, nothing. It doesn't do anything.
None of those students that were getting ready to run on the field were going, oh, but do we want to cost them $250,000 or whatever? Nobody was thinking about that. They're just going to go.
Let me pull up the fiscal budget for 2025 and make sure we can afford this.
Yes, exactly. Nobody's thinking about that. Nobody.
All right. Well, we appreciate you being with us today. We'll have another podcast tomorrow. Until then, hope you'll go to wholehogsports.com and read all of our latest Razorback coverage. We'll see you tomorrow.